Martha Johnson. I'm the administrator of the General Services Administration. Most of you who know these things would call it GSA, and that's not the Girl Scouts of America, it's the General Services Administration. We're if you think of John Berry worrying about the workforce, I worry about the workplace in the federal government. We have the building service, and we have what we call the acquisition service. So we worry about literally the buildings, for the judiciary, for the legislative branch, for the executive branch, for some state, local, for former presidents. We've got a lot of real estate. And then all the way across doing general commodity sales, so, you know, all this stuff, furniture, and so on, through IT, through airplanes, airplane reservations, credit card work, and so on, all the way through to consulting to you on how to do your contracting. So GSA is sort of one of the infrastructure agencies for the government, but we are in the front of the issues that we're facing today because we really are the technology and the real estate backbone. So when we think about the workplace for government workers, we carry a lot of burden about that. We also set policy for the government worker. So that's one of the reasons I'm privileged to be your facilitator moderator today. Before I joined the government, I was doing a lot of consulting and facilitation, so this is sort of like a home base for me. I have just a couple of things to open and say. First of all, thank you for the panel. I think we got going today with some great ideas. And this is a group, and I think our title is about getting to the meat of this. How do we actually make this work in the workplace? Making workplace flexibility work day to day for employees and employers. We got some good conversation going in the main room, and I want to continue that. You should know that we're being taped, and we are also someone is also taking notes, so that we're going to be able to collect and refine and have your ideas after the session and be able to share them with you. So keep that in mind. I think this is in some ways a brainstorming, but also a sharing session. So it's a chance for us to come from a number of different perspectives and do that. Secretary Solis will probably join us shortly in the middle of it. She's going to be here, but we're going to go ahead without her. And when she comes in, she'll just be joining the conversation with the rest of us. Now, what I'd like to do is have you know who's here. This is meant to be kind of popcorn, you know, like tell us quickly who you are, where you're from. We have academics, we have industry, we have advocates, we have government people. So I want you to get a flavor for who's in the room. And then I'll really pop the first sets of questions that I would like you to address. So let's just go around quickly.
Don Jones with Intel Corporation, Arizona.
Peter Berg, Michigan State University School of Human Resources and Labor Relations.
Michelle Clements with Recreational Equipment Incorporated, REI. Donna Klein, Corporate Voices for Working Families.
Sarah Manzano-Diaz, newly confirmed director of the Women's Bureau of Department of Labor.
Randy Shapiro, University of Washington, I have a work life preference there.
Hi, I'm Chris Rondo, and I'm a union leader in Cambridge and Mass, Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Persons and Hospitals.
Helen Putnam, the PNC Financial Services Group.
Linda Clement Holmes, Carpendale.
Beatrice Fitzpatrick, I'm president of the BOLD Initiative, and BOLD stands for Business Opportunities for Leadership Diversity. We're a nonprofit that's been working with major corporations around the country on diversifying their leadership, but also on flexibility of workplace.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Clark. I'm the Chief People Officer for JetBlue Airlines based out of New York.
Sharon Bernstein from Johnson & Johnson in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Jenny Whitner at Women Employed in Chicago.
Noreen Casper, the Timberland Company.
I'm Claire Shipman with ABC News.
Jody Levin Epstein with the Center for Law and Social Policy here in D.C.
Linda Merrick with 9 to 5, National Association of Working Women, and based in Colorado.
Alan Hubbard, Dow Corning, Michigan.
Catherine Hackney, the DuPont Company, Wilmington, Delaware.
Stu Friedman, the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia.
Marvelous. And now I want to have the people around the room also.
Joe Yosai, Service Employees International Union, SEIU, based in Massachusetts.
My name is Sarah, and I'm the Office of Public Engagement.
I'm Catherine Lewis, and I'm a
Jenny Kaplan, I'm the Deputy Director of the Rhode Island Council of Women and Girls.
Hi, my name is Allison Palmer, I'm with GSA Office of Communications.
I'm Terrell McSweeney, Domestic Policy Advisor to the Vice President and Deputy Assistant to the President for Policy.
I'm Dan Brunk, and I'm a reporter with the Huffington Post.
I'm Ellen Harris, I'm the Vice President of Human Resources for HEB Grocery Retailing, a family-owned private legal company out of Texas.
Latifa Lyles, Deputy Director of the Women's Bureau at the Department of Labor.
Peter Dorosky, I'm the Intern and Vice President of Press Office.
Marvelous. Now, we have three microphones here, as you can see. So those of you who are around the edge and wanting to contribute, I think we just project our voices. That's never been my problem, but I certainly invite you to do that. So I am basically eager to hear some of your stories and your best suggestions. Let me tell you what I was struck with today as I was listening to the panel. I have 12,600 employees across the country. We do teleworking in the government. That means we have a process by which people can sign up and take one day off and work from home. And because we're the technology people, we have made sure that everybody has laptops so that they can go home and work from home. I was just in our Kansas regional office, and there is a division there that now claims 90% of the organization is teleworking. They're moving to 2 days a week, so that's great. And I was thinking today that what I should do is I should go and challenge all managers. I've only been on the job a month, so I'm going to have all my stuff. I should challenge all managers to tell me why they're not teleworking. So that's probably the way to flip it. But not the employees, the managers. I think the managers are a critical link here, and I should just say that I think we've had a good experience with teleworking, but it's on us as GSA to be modeling and the change agent for attitudes and workplace innovation. So that's one of the reasons why I think that's a way to go about. So that was the aha I had in the middle of this. So what are your best examples of flexibility or the stories you would like other people to know about your experiences? I'd really particularly like to hear from industry or from the unions, just to be sure we're kind of getting those ideas out. Anybody want to start?
I'd be happy to start.
Oh, great. Good.
We have, and just a word or two of background, we have a credo that is really our guiding document, which we've had for 65 years. It was penned by Robert Wood Johnson. And it focuses, the first paragraph talks about our responsibility to our customers, the nurses and doctors, mothers and fathers who use our products and services. The second paragraph focuses on our employees, and the third paragraph on the employees in which we live and work. And then finally, the shareholders, importantly, we get the first three right. So in this credo responsibility to our employees, we recognize that this question of workplace flexibility is critical. But we also recognize that from a business perspective, in terms of achieving what we need to achieve, we need to have a workplace that is really diverse and inclusive. And in a place where you have diversity and inclusion of all, you need to have flexible work arrangements. And so we have an approach where we enable employees to actually propose what their flexible work arrangement looks like. And they can do this online. We have a website. You know, there's training for managers, training for individuals. They map
this
out.
So can they see each other's proposals?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and so it facilitates for both the manager and for the employee an approach where you learn what the options could be, but also where you recognize that you need to tie the business objectives for which you're responsible and then your performance and how you'll link those two.
Okay. So.
And in the last 3 years, we have found that 65% of employees surveyed say that this flexibility is part of what helped them make their decision to join Johnson & Johnson, so we think it's critically important.
Flexibility is a very important word here. I think flexible workplace, obviously, we've been discussing how it is not just flexible hours. There's a lot of other meanings to flexibility. And certainly, the business proposition for this, in this day and age, is that businesses need to be flexible, so you need to practice what you preach in all kinds of ways, just to get skilled at that. Interesting. Yes.
I've been with REI, and I've had the privilege of putting these programs in place over the last 12 years in three companies, and through the BOLD initiative, I've been a part of that initiative. And I'd say early on, it was about accommodation, but what we learned is that it became a key driver of engagement, which drove culture and results. REI, one of the things that we have all those programs, but one of our key company core values, along with service and respect, is balance. We're all expected to demonstrate balance in the workplace.
Well, that's very interesting. That's very tied into what you
yes.
are all about.
My first year at REI, that was my developmental list.
Values, credos. That's something that comes through. So you're working off a full philosophical foundation.
It's sort of an attitude. Ultimately, it becomes a part of your culture.
Right. Others?
I'm from the Timberland Company, as I mentioned. We're very similar, so I'll add on in terms of the philosophy and the belief to be an employer of choice and to have that flexibility is very important to our culture. We also talked about, you know, listening to employees and what they are looking for. One of the things that came up for us recently is we found that on days where schools were closed, we have an on-site daycare that takes care of kids before going to school. But once they're in school, then parents are facing different struggles, such as snow days. So up in New Hampshire, that's a big issue for us when schools close. And we had some parents that were bringing their kids to work, which obviously doesn't make them the most productive and can lead to some liability issues. So we quickly saw a need and went to our daycare provider, and they were able to create a program on site for school-age kids. So when schools close, and we've had a lot of that with the weather, you know, up in the Northeast, they've been able to bring their kids and be in a structured environment, and we get those parents to work, which is really important.
So this is sort of a swing space kind of a notion, swing school kind of a notion.
Absolutely. So we have a temporary site that, you know, on a moment's notice when schools close, parents can call and bring their kids in to work with them and be in a safe, fun environment.
We've been working under foundation grants since 2003 to develop under some foundation grants actually since 2003 to develop a process that would induce companies to offer more flexibility to their employees, and we have tested it by now in 20 major corporations around the country, and it works in every kind of industry, in every kind of team. It's a team-based approach, and I'll explain why. And in every function. So we've had research scientists in global labs for like Alcoa, or maintenance men at Gannett. I mean, really a whole range, newspaper delivery boys, a whole range of functions in any kind of industry almost that you can think of, and it has worked in every single one. And there are some characteristics about it that make it work. First of all, it's focused on increasing the bottom line for the company.
So there needs to be a business case.
Yeah, well, I learned long ago that business is about making money. Whether you like it or not, that's what business is about. And if you want business to do something, you have to show them how they're going to make more money doing it.
Exactly.
So that was a primary consideration. Another one was that it had to be inclusive. So instead of being a privilege that an individual gets from her manager, this is how work is done in the company, and all you have to do to be eligible is to be a member of a work team. And everyone on your work team has equal opportunity, not only opportunity, but that's part of it. The team decides what kind of flexibility each person needs for his own life. So it's not that everyone works X hours a week or X days a week. Everyone works the way they need to work for their life. This is critical because it means it's based on the reality of people's lives, and not someone in an office 5 miles away saying everyone is going to work X hours. And then it's also based on the reality of the work of the team. So there are no one solutions. Every team has its own plan for how it's going to do this based on the work it has to produce and the needs of its individual employees. And the team gets empowered here to figure out how are they going to get their work done. Part of the responsibility, the company says, look, we recognize that you have demands on you outside of here that you need to be able to manage, and we will give all of you the flexibility you need. In return, we have to remain competitive in the workplace, in the work, yeah, we have in the economy. And therefore, we need more productivity. So we will give you the flexibility you need, and you need to give us more productivity.
So that's the handshake.
Right. And so they're now each using each other's resources to get what they each need from each other, which makes people really work together.
This goes to what was mentioned on the panel about by the Campbell's people, that the creativity of the team is really extraordinary. If you offer the flexibility notion to a group of people, they'll figure out how to do it, and making that handshake is valuable.
So the team then has to figure out how it's going to, what kind of work schedule are they going to have, so each one gets the flexibility they need. The caveat is you can't make decisions that go to the home and just won't work. So there are various caveats, but as few as possible that the company lays out, like you can't do things that are going to increase our costs. You can't figure out a plan that's going to make us hire more people to get the work done. But they have to be told this up front.
What about examples where we have manufacturing? I know you said you're from DuPont, a couple of others, where you're probably, and SEIU work, where people are really in roles that require them, again, to be pretty face-to-face. Do you have any comments about that?
I'm here not because I'm in a human resources role. I'm actually started with DuPont as an engineer, and I work a part-time schedule.
Uh-huh.
And there's a couple hundred of us that work a reduced hour schedule, but we're a professional network, so we're not on the operator lines running the plants, although I took my first reduced hour schedule at a plant site where I was supporting the manufacturing area.
And how did that
work? For ag business. Well, I wasn't the first to work part-time. There were a couple other ladies at the time that were engineers that worked a reduced hour schedule. Typically, a lot of us that work part-time are dual career and dual DuPont career at that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. DuPont does love the dual careers. But in any case, not every job is conducive to part-time. At that point, my request was post my first child's birth, and I was a reliability engineer. So I was supporting equipment in, you know, a batch operation unit. You have to keep that equipment running, right? So they basically took the request under consideration, came back to me in a couple weeks. I had to prepare myself for the answer to be no. You know, that was really a decision I was waiting to have to make. Because I did not want to go back full time. I wanted to work 3 days a week, and that was the gist of it.
So now that's interesting. So your expectation was that making the request was important and fashioning it, but you knew that there would have to be a handshake and it perhaps was a no.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct, because it is a management decision at DuPont. We have a flexible work policy that includes various work, you know, flex place, flex time, compressed schedule, reduced hours, the whole gamut is in the policy. Whether you're granted the, you know, approval to implement that for yourself is completely a management decision.
I think it's very interesting to be in environments where the workforce can really do a lot around their own schedules. when I was working in manufacturing, we had an engine line, diesel engine manufacturer, and we had teams, and the teams decided when the engine line opened up in the morning. And the big discussion was during deer hunting season when it opened up and closed, and it was also however early you opened up, somebody had to come in 2 hours earlier to open to turn on the ovens because you were doing some things with the cam crankshafts. So it's but having that whole line synchronize itself and have some decisions about it, I think it's almost as much about allowing you to have that question as anything. Okay, I'm talking about.
I have some examples from manufacturing and research that we've done, and I think some of it. It's got constraints, obviously, from the process. In one food manufacturer, it was a unionized facility. There was nothing in the union contract regarding flexibility, yet a large number of the employees would swap shifts. So they would trade shifts as a way to gain flexibility, totally informally, and management was clear, understood that it was going on. And of course, they preferred that it be informal, but employees were getting flexibility. I think another example.
Is that a unionized plan?
Yes.
Good.
Another example in another facility was an oil refinery, and this is more an example of some of the constraints and the fact that sometimes flexibility requires sharing control, and I think that's a problem, that it's not always that managers will come to the right culture, the right conclusion. Sometimes there's a sense that we don't necessarily want to share control over the time. So. And it may be that we have constraints. This plant worked on 12-hour shifts, and someone would work their 12-hour shift, and if their relief shift would not come in or was absent, they would go through a roster of overtime people, and if nobody wanted the overtime, that worker would have to work six more hours. So you had this many people then having to work an 18-hour shift, and they could not refuse the overtime because they didn't have a right to refuse the overtime. So, within these operations where there are real constraints, the work has to be done, it's harder, but there are certainly things that could be done to rectify that. You didn't have to require six extra hours. That was a choice. And this was a unionized facility as well. So my point is that it can be done, but sometimes it's more difficult to do and it requires particular choices. And how the union facilitates that is a whole other issue. I won't go into that.
Choices. It's really a lot of choices. There was a hand up down here.
Yeah,
and then I'll move to you.
Well, I'm actually from higher ed, so I'm thinking not specifically about manufacturing, but I've been in the field for 20 years, and as I'm trying to think of what is the crust of what I want to say, it's really if you were to move forward launching a program where there wasn't already a culture change, where there wasn't necessarily good trust going on, how should you start to move forward in flexibility in the workplace? And I think, and Claire mentioned this, is daily flexibility is one of the most important characteristics for people in the workplace so that they can have control over their daily schedule. And that really does lend itself to a variety of different venues that just the daily flexibility, you can come in late, you can go to a doctor's appointment, you can use your sick leave to care for a family member. That daily flexibility is really, I think, the cornerstone of flexibility. The other piece is training of supervisors and managers so they understand how to respond to it. We can have fantastic work-life programs and services. If the manager is standing in the way, it's just not going to happen. So it's the training of the managers. And then the third piece is the performance management cincture, because how are you managing someone who's not in the workplace when you can't see them, when you're managing FaceTime? And I think those are the three areas that we really need to see more work in.
You know, down in Kansas City, as I said, I've got a group down there that is really tackling this telework thing pretty hard. And this is just our construct in the government. But this last week, what they put everybody through was generational training, which I usually think of that as kind of a nice to have in the environment. It's sort of a fun thing, you know, get people together and kind of facilitate a team. But this is real generational training with four levels so that the various age groups and their attitudes about technology and about control and seeing people and all of those protocols was discussed. I just thought that was basic for their telework training. I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. I think you had.
I just wanted to comment on the importance of the hourly conversation and the manufacturing, not only manufacturing but all.
Because I'm not applying the present for Voices for Working Families. We are going to be doing the campaign to get employers involved that Valerie Jarrett mentioned this morning. And so certainly all you employers, we'd love to have you participate with us. PNC is already part of us. Johnson & Johnson is part of our business coalition as well.
But we have done extensive research on the professionals, well as the hourly workers, and there is really exciting work going on for the non-exempt, whether they're manufacturing, whether they're service workers, whether they are in retail, et cetera. We have a research report with five major companies participated in, all with hourly. It's on our website, corporatevoices.org. I brought a copy. It's innovative workplace flexibility options for the hourly workforce. This was a longitudinal study. It really goes into what these companies are doing. It's really the future of flexibility. It's easy to do flexibility for management professional people by and large. We've been doing it for a lot of years working on the issue. It's very hard at the line level. And I think that's the real next step in terms of the overall body of knowledge on flex.
Yes, I'm Procter & Gamble, and we've had flexible work arrangement policies for a long time. So compressed work week, you know, all these other kinds of things, job sharing, working from home. But I think we've finally moved to where a lot of, particularly around telecommuting, has become more systemic. We have a program where we combine those kind of things, telecommuting, with flexible workspace. So the workspace is designed for that. So for example, we have whole work groups that no longer have permanent offices. Mm-hmm. So the workspace is designed for that. So take all the pictures of your family and all your trinkets and everything and take those home or wherever you want to put them.
Your doggy arters.
Right, exactly. Because that space is no longer necessarily your space. It's the space for when you come in and drop in for the day or whatever. Right. But what that drives is more of that flexible kind of behavior. We combine that then with training for managers. What do you do when you don't see people every day? How do you communicate? Yes, they really are working if you can't see them. You know, and how do you read the results? Those kind of things. With technology, they have to have the right technology so when they do work from home, they can connect. They can connect just as well at home as they can, you know, anywhere else. They have the right computers and everything else. With the culture, so all those pieces together, the workspace, with the policy, with the technology, with the training of the managers in terms of how do you read performance, with the culture all together, is what makes it a bit more systemic, particularly within a complete work group.
I know we're talking about systemic things, but if you had to start with one of those, which would be the interrupter that would begin to get people's attention, where you could just kind of crank that flywheel the first time?
You know what was interesting is, and probably the most difficult hurdle, was really the workspace. Mm-hmm. Okay, because all of a sudden, because it forces you not to be there every day. You don't have a choice. And then that workspace is also compressed. So we have a much higher occupancy rate, right?
Financial.
So now you're talking about, right, so there's a business case behind it. So now you're talking about occupancy is like more like 125%. Mm-hmm. So everybody can't come in at the same time. So that's probably what really drove it. But there's behavior that's really difficult to get over with that around managers, like I said, reading performance, employees, how do I make sure that I'm still getting visibility? You know, how do I communicate and all those other kinds of things? So that's really, I think, what forces it probably more so than everything else. But once you kind of get past that hurdle, people love it.
There is some tipping point that happens. And I think that, you know, with core concepts and philosophies and culture changes and big systemic programs, you can address all those things. But sometimes just where do you begin? Down here, now I have turned to the center of the table. Let me go with you and then you.
Jody at the Center for Law and Social Policy, you know, beauty of this issue as a social issue is that it's universal. Our organization is focused on low-income workers, and so the question becomes, you know, what Donna was raising with hourly workers and low-wage workers, and how do you give them the sense of control? And so it's kind of exciting that in McDonald's, there's a corporate example of McDonald's testing that swap that's made between the workers on their own without the manager, and so that gives those workers a sense of control. We've been trying to get out of McDonald's the results of that evaluation and haven't yet been able to do that, but it would be kind of an exciting model to kind of bring over. It may be actually being done by other independent McDonald's in the United States as well. But another UK innovation, which is an impossible government role if you're looking to change the gestalt of the entire culture, and I think all of the efforts, including the one Don is talking about launching, are really, really important, is that over in the UK, a bill was enacted called the right to request flexible work, which is only the right to request it. It is not the right to give it. But given the conversation here in terms of worker understanding management, A piece of that process was that the worker went to the employer and had to explain how the manager, the employer, could manage the change. So it put the employee in the position of trying to understand both the mission and the operations. And so that is a very interesting dimension. The Blair administration, which launched this effort, was gangbusters about it, and all of their reports on their website indicate that it has changed gestalt. You know, one of the tricks here would be how you get all employers of all kinds of workers to buy in, but I think if there's a parallel effort to get hourly employers to be doing it, this could help goose the idea of flexible work across the board. And there is a bill in Congress also that's set and modeled after the UNK bill right now.
Well, that's interesting. I think that this notion of having everybody answer the question, why bother, is really an important, you know, business case analysis is sort of imposing for a worker who's trying to figure out how to make a case. But just answer the question, why should you bother doing this? You know,
to jump in and answer that, we talked a little bit about the hourly worker. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I need to turn.
I'm with HEB's or Grocery Retailing Company out of Texas. We have about 71,000 partners across Texas and Mexico. And majority of our workforce is hourly, non-management. If you think about the workers that you would have inside a grocery retail store or some of our manufacturing plants. And really, we had to start flexible scheduling, and have done it as long as I can remember, out of necessity. Because if you think about the type of worker that begins at a grocery store, it's probably their first job. They're probably in school, could be in high school. A lot of times people see it as a second career. So we have school teachers, we have stay-at-home moms, we have people from all different types of backgrounds who work there part-time. And so when you think about flexible scheduling, it has to be a necessity for the business, because you have to be able to employ people who may not plan on that being a career. I've been with the company for 19 years, and I can tell you, almost everyone I've ever met that's been there a period of time says, I never planned on this being a career. I did it as a part-time job, and the next thing you know, I've been here for 20 years. And that's because of the flexibility that provides. We have schedule swapping, where you can post it on the system so that the manager does not have to get involved. I don't want to work these shifts that I was scheduled. Oh, I would like to work those shifts. It happens automatically. They're able to do that. Of course, there's part-time. Most of our workforce is part-time. And it's all by the employee preference. They tell us, these are the hours and the days that I'm able to work. It goes into the system, and the system spits out a schedule based upon what the availability is of the business needs, and that partner. And many times, if the partner's hours are constricted because of that, they understand they have to open it up. You mentioned something earlier about the different generations, and just over time, I think there has been a thought that if you want to work retail, you have to be open anytime availability. You know, Monday through Sunday, from open to close, and that was a paradigm we had to change, because technically, we want more people to work in the evenings, because that's when most folks shop. In the evenings after work, less people to work during the days, and you'd be surprised when you have a huge base of one particular store can have up to 500 people working in it. There's always someone who wants to work mornings, there's always someone who wants to work evenings, there's always someone who wants to work Saturday and Sunday, and some folks who don't want to work Saturday and Sunday. And so I think a lot of times it's with technology, and are you able to have a system facilitate those changes and make the matches between what the business needs are and what the employee needs are. Because, as you might know, the grocery store sales fluctuate. We schedule based on sales. So beginning of the month, when people get their checks, or maybe when assistance is provided, more sales. End of the month, less sales. And so the schedule fluctuates, but also it's the employee who gets to dictate what they are willing or able to work, and the schedule is only made that way.
I want to tag that, because I'd like to be sure we talk about how technology can influence, but Jenny, your turn.
And I'm glad we're having this conversation about low-paid hourly workers, because that's what we're focused on, too. And too many times the flexibility in that case, particularly in retail and, you know, service sectors like hospitality, accrues to the employer, not to the employee. So the employer has the flexibility to send someone home if there aren't enough shoppers in the store, the flexibility to change someone's shift the day before, not to set schedules at all until a couple of days before. And what workers in that kind of job need is more often predictability and stability, as well as flexibility. So it's great to hear the HEB example, where you're using both technology and sort of a paradigm change to work on those kinds of issues. But I really think that as we talk about the issue of flexibility, we need to take into account that the needs for stability and predictability are also there for low-paid workers.
Yeah, do like to, okay, I'll you and then you and you. Okay, go for it. Oh, and then JetBlue. Okay, go for it.
CEO Science with SEIU, and we represent healthcare workers in the public sector and property service, the low-wage workers, the cleaners and security officers, food service, and what you just said is totally right. And I think especially going back to the panel, the issue of having the basic day to be part of the flex time, it is so essential. This is part of like what many of the low-wage workers, when we ask what is the most important thing, aside from wages and healthcare, sick day is one of the most important issues for them. So in our union, in all the contracts that we negotiate with our employers, we address the issue of sick days and pay sick day, and leave, like just having that time to be able to be with your family and your kids. In particular, in our industry, we represent the cleaners. They come at night after 5 or 6 p.m., and this is exactly the time when their kids are at home, or they're not even at home sometimes. So for our workers is, how do we balance this issue? It's been so every single day in their lives. So one thing that we have done as a way to address this in a much more comprehensive and larger is to partner with the industry. In this case, commercial office buildings, this is the real estate. So how do we do this together? Because having workers who feel that they are okay, that they have taken care of their families, they're gonna be much more productive, they're gonna be more happy, and they're gonna be at work, and the turnover is gonna be much less. Because this is some of the industries that people come and go. So this is addressing many different issues. So one, I think, especially in the real estate, what we see is that we are moving from the traditional hours of the day evening is being important. And it's also changing a little bit of, this is the traditional time. So when you are after school, after work, you're gonna be able to be with your kids. But it's also a matter of like, when we go with the employers, we say this is also your benefit. Aside from the part you're gonna have much productive and happier workers, it is an issue in our industry, energy conservation and moving into green building is a matter of all of that. So some of addressing this issue and being able to have a collective discussion with the employers and with the industry, it is very important. So the union voice in how we make this flex time work for low wage workers and all workers in the different industry system.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Your turn.
So again, I think my comments are going to just build on these, because at 9 to 5, our concern also is with the interests of low wage workers. And the kinds of issues that Rocio is talking about, paid sick days and paid family and medical leave, are the least likely to be offered to low-wage workers. And at the same time, they are the least able to be able to afford having to take time off work and not get some kind of compensation for them. So we, applaud the efforts of the employers in this room and the great work that you're doing. And we're interested in thinking about how all together we can promote those things. But we also really feel like there needs to be some minimum standards around some of these really basic core kinds of issues around flexibility in the workplace, specifically around paid sick days and around family and medical leave. Because those are things, and particularly with paid sick days, not everybody, thank goodness, is going to need to utilize the Family and Medical Leave Act in their career if they're eligible for it, but everybody gets sick, right? And everybody has family members who need their assistance from time to time. So, to be able to promote both the best practices, but also to establish kind of a standard that all employers are meeting in terms of all of their workforce, not only professional workforce, but also low wage workers, hourly workers as well. And a couple of other things that I just hadn't heard mentioned too much, a couple of people talked about part-time work, which can really be fabulous, right? For workers who need flexibility, so long as that it's voluntary and so long as it is equitable, so that people don't feel like they are penalized for going to a part-time work schedule. And so that's one important thing. And the, another issue that 9to5 has worked on in a number of places is some flexibility around the ability of parents to be able to attend school functions with their children. And in fact, we worked with an employer in Colorado who was even going above and beyond that, but actually kind of established it as a value that their employees would contribute to the community in the field of education. So for parents, that was pretty easy. It looked like going to school conferences or going to school activities. But for other folks, it meant working with school districts to develop computer systems. I mean, it was really the kinds of things that they were contributing to the community made a huge difference for those kids, for those families, and for their businesses.
Interesting. JetBlue.
Sure. There was someone ahead of me, but I'll start.
Go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to say, first of all, JetBlue is a relatively new company on the horizon. We've only been around for 10 years. So I think in a lot of ways, we've actually learned a lot from the movement or the journey that a lot of you have really pioneered. Because I think when our company started 10 years ago, we recognized that we needed to be flexible. So from when we started our operation, we actually started with flexibility as our business model. So what does that mean? We have about 84% of our workforce. We, much like you, we've got about 13,000 crew members across the country. But 84% of them are hourly workers. And what I really wanted to talk about where I think the perfect storm comes together is at our reservation center. That represents about 16% of our workforce. These are the people you call when your flights got problems. These are the people who helped you find a new flight. But our model going into our reservation center was to really make that a highly flexible workforce because we recognized that most of the people that we were recruiting for that were people who were looking for a second income to support their household, and most of them were women. And the truth is, if you look at the numbers, about 88% of those folks are women, and nearly all of them, 97%, work from home 7 days a week. So what we've done is we've actually equipped them with the workspace and the technology and the tools that allows them to work from home. And they have a flexible work schedule to the point where 67% of them are part-time workers. And what we found to be the real benefit of this workforce is that when we put together a healthcare plan that allowed our part-time crew members to have the same healthcare benefits as our full-time folks, made a huge difference in terms of engaging the workforce. So the net result of this is that we've got our workforces, when we do our annual survey of our organization, this particular center, these 2,000 crew members, have our highest engagement, they have our highest productivity, and we continue to be recognized by J.D. Power as being one of the more user-friendly consumer service companies in this zone. So I think when you put it all together, the workspace, the flexibility, the part-time hours, the shift you had on your time in terms of your slots, it makes a big difference. And then when you put the medical benefits to part-timers,
it's a huge
benefit.
So it's not prorated?
No.
That's huge.
It's huge. So when you put it all together, again, it's a business model, and I just want to applaud all of you because I think we've learned from the journey that I think a lot of you have been on and tried to decide as we built our business model for a successful brand that's now 10 years old, we've actually benefited from all of your work. So if we could offer, if we could turn it back to you, we'd love to be able to offer that for you.
Thank you. I'll turn it.
Thanks. Yes, yeah, Stu Friedman of the Wharton School. About 20 years ago, we started the Wharton Work-Life Integration Project, which was about research and practice on how people can better integrate the different parts of their lives, particularly business leaders. And I'm happy to say that 20 years later, we've got an elective course on leadership from the perspective of the whole person that's all about how you integrate the different parts of your life for mutual gain. So what we do in this program, which is, again, oversubscribed course now for our second year MBAs and executive MBAs and for companies around the world that are using this approach, what they're learning how to do is to create change that is sustainable because it works not just for them, for their businesses, but also for their families and their communities and society. Mm-hmm. So what we're teaching them is that leadership in business is not about business so much as it is about life. And that's an idea that has really taken hold now as the young people in 2010 and beyond are hungry for models of leadership that are not just about the business world, but about their whole lives. And they're really desperate for useful knowledge and for the authorization from people older than them that it's a good thing to be looking at how you pursue these four-way wins. What small steps can you take that are going to benefit not just yourself and your boss and your clients, but in addition, your family and your community in a demonstrable way? And so they learn how to do this by taking small steps, small wins over the course of a month or two that are designed to demonstrably make things better for their boss or their client, their business life, their home life, their community life, and perhaps most importantly, their selves, mind, body, and spirit. And because it's small and pitched to make winners of the people around them, they overcome the fear or the guilt that you so eloquently addressed in the panel. The piece and that's what holds people back from innovation, is they're afraid or they feel guilty or they're just ignorant about what's possible. So what we train them to do is to focus first on what matters most to you. You've got to be real and clarify what matters most to you. Then figure out the people around you, what do they care most about? So we actually have them talk to their so-called key stakeholders, people at work, people at home, people in the community. What are our mutual expectations? What do we need from each other? And then to look at all of that as a system and say, okay, now what steps can I take that are going to make things better for you and for me and also for my mother and my friends? And what we find is that when people undertake this approach and then experiment with ways of getting things done more intelligently, sometimes by changing where they work or how they work or bounding time for certain things that allow them to just focus on one thing at a time, which is a big issue today, or just taking care of themselves through nutrition or exercise, what we find is that they tend to take time and attention away from work and dedicate it more to their home and family and personal lives, and their performance at work goes up. So they're spending less of their attention on things that don't matter because they're delegating or they're focusing on the things that matter because they know better what matters because they've explored that. And they end up reducing the time and attention to work and devoting more to the other parts of their lives, but it doesn't reduce their performance, it rather increases it. We have some good evidence to show that paradoxical effect. So they're learning how to lead from the perspective of their whole lives. And that's what we're trying to do to educate the next generation of business leaders and their companies.
Very interesting, because I think leadership is one of those bits that folds in, and somebody mentioned it at the beginning. You haven't had a chance yet.
Thank you. Dow Corning in Midland, Michigan. It's interesting to listen to the stories and the challenges that many of you have. We're a lot like JetBlue. We look at Dow Corning as not being an employer of 10,500 people. There are 10,500 individuals that make up Dow Corning. That when someone comes to work, they don't come to work without the baggage that they left behind in the morning or they're going home to it in the evening. So when we employ someone, we're employing them for the full 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And so what can we do to eliminate the noise in their lives that allows them to focus on the very things that we hired them to do? So if we can take care of the basic health care needs in our organization, in the U.S., whether you're union, non-union, exempt, non-exempt, we all share in the same benefits package. Right? If you're full-time, part-time, it's the same benefits package. You pay the same amount. Right? We have a smorgasbord of offerings with regards to alternative work schedules, with regards to job sharing. It is there. What we've learned is it's come down to basically the relationship between the employee and their boss. That is the significant relationship. We started a few years ago with in our annual performance reviews. The first thing every manager in Dow Corning looks at in terms of when they're doing evaluations of managers below them is the people relationship. Did they spend time, to your point, are they modeling behavior? Are they worried about the signals they're sending? Are they an impediment to the very essence of our culture? And if they are, then we deal with that. So I think we've taken a holistic look and said, look, we're going to get the noise out of the way. We're going to deal with the things that, so we do concierge services, and we do all the things that everyone else does. But it is all flavored around how do we allow the employee to be most successful in the workplace by removing the noises that are outside and allowing them the flexibility to be what they need to be in order for them to be what we need them to be.
Sort of a surround sound notion.
Right.
Now the other thing that I take away from that is the notion of technology for communications, that indeed this the noise in life is in part about knowing what's going on when you're at work and you don't know what's happening at home. And I've always thought that there could be so much more to be done about helping people communicate through their workplace to the outside partners that they have to stay in touch with. Yes.
I'm not the expert that most of you here are, but I have a broad knowledge, having written this book, and so dipped in on a lot of the work that everybody's done. And I think that and we've heard some of this already, but it seems to me that what we found in our research and speaking to a lot of companies and employees subsequently is one of the keys is for a company to have the mindset shift to measuring results. And once you start to realize that that's the goal, you can never go back again. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense anymore to have somebody say, well, you know, where's Bob at 8 o'clock? It goes away. But that's a challenge in a lot of industries to figure out there's some things that aren't so easy to measure. But we've seen companies get really creative in figuring out ways to measure, you know, video training or public relations. I mean, there are ways to sit down and figure out what you expect your employees to do, and any company trying to do a good job should be doing that anyway, but you'd be surprised that that doesn't always make sense. And I think that the other thing that really seems to make a huge difference is having that bit of control we were talking about. It's not so much about what the program is it flex time, part time? It's treating your employees like grown-ups and giving them some autonomy. And that they, you know, whether there's so many good examples of this, when the group makes the decision, it makes sense, or when the employee is trusted, yes, they will be working, and you know, and that ties into the results too. And the other two things I've seen is that it's really hard for this to happen anyplace unless the very top is motivated to do it. Because again, I think somebody else brought this up, if they don't see it coming from the top, and if the managers don't feel the top looking for this as a result, it doesn't tend to happen. And I also think that what I've heard from people is that the biggest stumbling block to this is helping the managers, training the managers, getting them in the right mindset, because it's hard to move to different ways of measuring people and to figure out what's expected, and it's not natural in a lot of ways. And that, I think, is very often a big obstacle for people and what creates a lot of the fear.
Managers are often managers because they've been rewarded for a certain kind of behavior, and that's how they've come up the ladder. And unless you clearly change signals on them, they're not going to understand it. I think that the notions here that you're expressing are summed up in this notion of the difference between asserting control and creating order. Because asserting control is a top-down power notion where you're on top of things, you can see it, you know it, you hold it. But if you can create a partnership where you're working on creating order together, I know I can't control my life, but if I can have a little bit of order about it, it's a notion. B, you wanted to say something. Yeah, I'm going to turn to this end of the table again.
Several people have alluded to, and one of the things I think is most exciting about this whole thing is the interconnection that it creates. You just start with flexibility, and before you know it, people are treating each other with respect, because the company is giving out, is treating you with respect. And managers suddenly realize their employees are much smarter than they ever realized. And employees who have to take responsibility for results think it's not so easy to be a manager. And that's the beginning of really good feelings and teammates who want the kind of flexibility they get in order to live their life well, really want to help each other. They start functioning like real teams, not just nominal teams. And then what happens is it spreads out to the community, which several people have alluded to. I mean, we're into something that's very, very at the heart people living together. This is not just about flexibility. It's about how work gets done. It's about how people relate to each other. And when you give people flexibility in the workplace, where do they start doing the bed time? A lot of parents want to get back to their kids' school, and suddenly they have the time. A lot of people want to do other things with their lives, and they suddenly have the time. And remember when there was this big, when women started going to work in big numbers, there was like a big sucking sound in the community. All the volunteers left the schools and the churches, everybody was going to work. Now suddenly, with flexibility, we have the opportunity to turn that around. And not only turn it around, but this time, you have men as well as women, because these things apply to everybody, not just to women. And you also have volunteers who have experience in making things happen. You've been given the opportunity to think and work with people and get results. You take those skills back into the community. So the kind of skilled volunteers you get and the quality is much higher than what it used to be.
Yes.
Now, we have the community, the employees and their families, and the companies all mutually supporting each other. And just imagine, look at the atmosphere in our country today, and just imagine how it can, I see it changing this way. And I see it starting in the workplace, because people don't screw around with their jobs at work. They may act crazy in a neighborhood where they're not accountable. But at work, you don't do that. So if we can start developing, now this is not just about profit, it's about life. If we can start developing good experiences of people working together and getting good results that are good for everyone around them, you begin to change some of the nastiness that's flowing around the air in this country.
It creates a great liftoff. Let me move to you, and then I'm going to come back around here.
I think we at PNC have had flexible work arrangements for a long time. Formal work arrangements in a lot of the areas that we've been talking about, and one of the things that Donna's research shows and we've been talking about here today is the importance of having episodic flexibility in the workplace where people could take off and for a school event or a doctor's appointment for a child or for themselves or a parent. One of the interesting shifts that we are starting to see is in our evolution years ago, it was the employee who was asking for and initiating requests for flexible work schedules. Now we're seeing it shift more to managers beginning to ask to be educated about how do we do it and how do we institute it, and getting their work teams to work on coming together with a design and taking ownership over it and developing measurements for outcomes. And they're doing it because the business case has been met and it's been demonstrated. So all the things we're talking about is attraction and retention of talent, a reduction of absenteeism, reduction in certain instances of the need for overtime, increased productivity, a more engaged workforce, which we've all seen the research and shown anecdotally, leads to a more productive and a more successful business. So the work case is there. And in response to your question, you know, how do you get it started with if you have a group of managers or you have an organization that hasn't really done it? And pilot programs are a terrific experiment. You start a pilot program, some will work, some won't work. You'll see why, what were the barriers in the pilot program, and you work on those for the next programs. And if they're successful, to give anecdotes of successes in pilot programs where you have an ecstatic workforce and productivity has increased and employee engagement has increased and absenteeism has decreased is a very exciting thing, and it becomes very contagious. The other thing we do is in all of these things, you evaluate them on a periodic basis. So when our managers and our individual employees design a flexible work program, we evaluate it every 6 months. The manager and the employee evaluates it. Is it working? Isn't it working? Should it continue? and should we make changes? So those are other ways to, that, you know, so many of these things, if you haven't done them before, seem so overwhelming, but if you engage by periodically reevaluating whether it works or doesn't work, even on a formal schedule, and doing pilot programs and learning from the pilot programs, I think we've seen tremendous success from them.
Thank you for that. We'll go to you and then we'll move right around the table.
I just want to build off a comment, some comments that were made on the low and middle income workers. And I think there are three things that are very important that, that these workers need. One was mentioned, predictability. Predictability in the hours that I'm to work, the schedule I'm to work, and knowing that ahead of time. The other basic thing, knowing that you have some kind of floor of leaves. And the other important piece is the ability to adjust your schedule. We talk about daily adjustment, schedule adjustment. So having that ability to adjust, and that can be done through a technological solution where I put up a computer program, self-scheduling, self-swapping of shifts. It might be done through a work restructuring. We're going to move to teamwork. Think of an apparel industry that was organized all in rows. They switched to teams. This was years ago. Work was measured differently, and because teams now shared work, they were ability to let one go early to attend the school simply because of the way they reorganized the work. So there are organizational solutions that can deal with that. And then I think, well, what can unions do? There's not a lot of research about what's unions' role in this. And I think what unions have done is they've dealt with the first two pretty well. They've dealt with predictability. If you want to readjust people's shifts and things, you need to give notice. They've dealt with paid leaves. The harder piece has been daily adjustment or adjusting schedule, because that's a differentiated solution. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It depends on what's the work organization in that unit, professionals versus line people. And I think where some of the best work has been done, and I'm thinking Harvard clericals who've gone beyond the contract and said, we can't have a one-size-fits-all solution, but we can negotiate a commitment to flexibility. And we then can support it by providing counselors to individuals on how to negotiate with their supervisor a flex schedule. By providing a problem-solving procedure when there's disagreement about it, they can tap into a joint labor management committee that can help realize a solution. By providing consultants to areas on, well, how do I reorganize this call center into a compressed work week? Union representative, management representative gets together and negotiates that. So that union has gone beyond simply negotiating provisions and has set up a structure by which you can actually implement differentiated scheduling adjustment.
Interesting. Would you just add to that, since that's your union?
Yeah, I'd like to speak to that a little bit. I mean, JetBlue is so new, and Harvard is so ancient. And it's very, very decentralized. Peter has studied it a little bit. And, you know, it's quite an enormous task to engage in culture change. So when labor and management decided initially that we were not going to have the kind of labor agreement that has work rules, but we're instead going to be able to kind of negotiate every little problem. You know, in a way, we didn't know what we were getting into. When we started to negotiate all these little issues about time and flexibility at work, in our first several years, this is 20 years ago, 50% of our problem-solving cases, which were done by labor and management together, were about flexibility and scheduling and everything that everyone said about educating people, managers and workers, was the primary thing that we learned at that time. But what we figured out over time is that there are so many little things that occur that are so hugely important to people. It's not just about having children, although we all know, you know, having children, our children need us sometimes, right? And all the supports in the world are not good enough. They need us. Also to support learning. So especially around our hourly workers, our low-wage workers, if time for learning isn't figured out flexibly into their lives, they're going to be in
a stuck position for a long time, earning very little, probably two jobs, et cetera. And then we also noticed that everyone has a serious problem at some point or another. Every single worker, no matter labor management, we all end up taking care of someone who's extremely ill, or we end up very ill ourselves at some point or another. And this has a huge impact on work. So all these things have to be negotiated differently. You know, you could go on and on about these things, but for us, what occurred to us is that skill can always trump power in these things, that we do these things in a spirit, I think, that people here mentioned, trust. But of course, you get to know each other and you negotiate every little thing. And it seems like so much work at first, but really it isn't. What happens is you end up with thousands of people who have the ability to negotiate informally what they need, and their needs change yearly. Pretty much every time you have a child, every time, you know, your mom goes to, you know, have a oral surgery or whatever, your life is changing. And if you add education to that and say, well, we're for education for every single worker, then you can't have a one-size-fits-all solution.
That is just a very powerful story about how you also were collecting data and watching patterns. You know, the home of getting to yes, right? Yes, I'll go to you too because you've been patient.
So as I look at the sort of look backward to the leap forward, mm-hmm. I want to highlight Alan from Dow, because one of the key learnings that for me has been an overt bias in this movement, and that overt bias is to people with families, that they got to be the early adopters and they got the freedom to take part in workplace flexibility, where people who were single or people who didn't have families did not get the same privilege, and it created a resentment.
Yes.
So you had this highly engaged workforce who got to partake, and then you had those who were staying behind and working all the hours. And so looking at an organization like Dow, where it says we're all individuals, and how do we all take a part of this initiative that it isn't just designed for one set worker, and it links beautifully to diversity and inclusion. So I guess as I, you know, look at this group around the table and say, you know, if we're taking the leap forward, it's taking the leap forward for everyone in the organization and really providing them the opportunity to make a difference. At REI, we drive a business. We're in the climbing, hiking business, but we're also a mission-based organization. Our people leave the workplace and go take part in a part of the mission that matters to them. It might be protecting open spaces, it might be working with kids, getting them into the outdoors, but they return to communities in a way that really is profound, and it's affording everyone the opportunity as well.
Can I build on that one second?
Okay, then we'll go to Donna.
I still hear, and I'm going to shift a little and potentially incur the wrath of the room, but let me ask a different
open
question.
Open the door so we can run.
Okay, but I often hear a hesitation from people about going down the path of flexibility, because typically it creates a signal of a so-called mommy track that leads me to slower promotion, less pay, and less career opportunities. And that is a barrier for people to think about flexibility. I guess I'm curious, some of you are nodding your heads, so are we over that hump, or is that still a reality that's out there today?
Your turn.
I can address it, then I'm gonna tell my story, but
okay.
We're not over that.
Okay.
It's still a very, very big challenge. A lot of it has to do with how it's positioned and how it was positioned years and decades ago when I started to work, but it is a valid concern. One way you can address it within your organization is to promote and advance people who are on using flexible work arrangements and shine the light on
it.
So I think that's good. I wish we were over that. But let me tell my story, because I think it relates to this, all of the concerns about hourly workers and non-exempt workers and barriers to flexibility and management training. I spent more than 20 years at Marriott before I founded Corporate Voices, but one of the most amazing pieces of research I did was we were implementing flexibility, trying to in the hotels years and years and years ago. And met with a lot of resistance on the manager's parts. So we did a piece of research in the hotel. This was a very big, we call it a convention hotel. And the most amazing finding of the piece of research was this, and you could all conclude what you want from it. We surveyed the managers, and the most, with respect to flexibility and people not being there, the managers were more comfortable visually being able to see an employee not working than they were not seeing an employee, not seeing an employee and wondering if they're working. It's a very profound finding. You know, it talks about training managers and knee-jerk reactions and the importance of trust.
Say that one more time. Say the conclusions one more time.
Well, it just is a, says a lot about trust in the...
they're fine, the specific finding, they were more comfortable seeing an employee not being
working
there.
No, seeing an employee not working.
Oh, like
so you'd have somebody at the front desk reading a paper. They were less distressed by that than not seeing an employee there. In other words, not being able to observe them working.
I want to be sure we get that clear.
Are you clear on that?
Yes. I mean, it's amazing.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Intel.
Yes, I wanted to address your issue about at Intel, I was an administrative assistant, a single parent for 12 years, and went through a divorce and wanted to do something different, and the job sent me back to school. I attained my bachelor's degree. And I ascended the ranks, and then they sent me back to school for my master's degree at Syracuse, which I live in Arizona, so you have to be really flexible to support that. And there's no stopping me now. So I, they don't know that, but. What I wanted to say, and what I think I'm just echoing what a lot of people are saying here, that management buy-in is very critical. I think educating managers on how important it is, having people like me and other people within the company that have those stories of, I was an hourly worker when I was an administrative assistant, and they paid for me to go to school both times, both degrees. The company paid for and supported. We do volunteering. We flex people's hours where we have a coordinated volunteer program during work hours where employees go out. And not only do they go out, we match that with $10 per hour for the nonprofit that they volunteer at. And again, when employees are comfortable and passionate about the things that they do and know that their employer are supporting those things, they want to come to work. They want to. I was just telling Martha that I didn't think I would be working for Intel for this long. It's been 13 and a half years, but being a single parent and being able to come and say, my daughter's sick, I have to leave right now. There's no one for me to call. And them saying, okay, you have a BlackBerry, you're on email, you have a telephone. If we need you, we'll get in touch with you. That is a beautiful thing for employees to have, and you want to work for a company like that that supports those type of things. We also have a program called a sabbatical, which mine is coming up, where every seven years. It's a different kind of sabbatical. You'll love this. Every 7 years, every employee, full-time employee gets 2 months off paid.
Do you have to write a book?
No. Most people go on vacation or do nothing, but that is in addition to their vacation time. So some people have babies, get married,
that's a fast
they have to time it exactly right, but they add their other vacation times on there. And
I'm just recruited.
There you go. And I'm coming up on 14 years, but the thinking is that after so many years in the same job, a lot of people tend to take less vacation time, and they're burnt out. So if you force them to go and take a force, and it's 2 months straight, you can't take 2 days here and a week here, it is 2 months, your job is guaranteed when you get back. And most employees come back refreshed, they want to do something different. And it's just it's a good thing for companies to support.
I will say one thing about the whole flexibility situation being sort of centered around us thinking about people having children. I think the whole demographic shifting, and it's now about people taking care of elderly, and where some people don't have children, we all have parents. And I also echo this business about, I was in a consulting firm, with a whole bunch of young consultants, and
I was so shocked when they would, I mean, I shouldn't have been, but they came in and would say, well, you know, you're doing it for them because they're having babies, but you know, I'm a single woman and I feel like I'm, you know, and it's really true. It's true. We need to think of people in that whole 360 way. Yes.
We have been talking about many, many great ideas, and this theme of training keeps coming up. And one of the things that we found that's really important is to have on-demand training, because our experience is people can be trained and it's not relevant in that very moment, and then when they're really faced with a situation, they really don't want to be reading a manual, they right. really need it. And so I think that's an important component to build in to whatever the program is, that training is available on demand when managers or leaders are faced with a situation.
I think that's the training piece has been mentioned over and over again.
I'd like to bring us back to the point that for some workers, flexibility means having the ability to have a day that's paid for illness or taking care of a child or whatever. And it's really awesome to be in this room with these great employers who clearly are taking care of their own employees in that way, and to have the First Lady this morning speak to paid sick days, and I certainly hope the President will as well. But I would... I've had a chance to have a number of conversations with a number of the employers in the room already who have expressed an interest and a willingness in giving voice to the idea, as the First Lady made mention this morning, that the Healthy Families Act is a important universal, and Secretary Solis, you have also been out there and you've had staff testify, and it's just been fabulous to have that. So it would also be fabulous to have the support of many employers' voices, and I've already been able to collect a few of you already in this room, but if I can come up to everybody, or if you could pass cards to me, the Center for Law and Social Policy, which works in coalition with many of the groups around this table, would love to be in touch with you to pull together some sort of unified, this is not anything, unified commitment to something.
All right, we got the pitch. Yes.
I think the topic we've talked about a few times about community and paid time off for service, mm-hmm. that's a big thing for us at Timberland, because we give employees 40 hours per year to serve in their communities, and it goes across all corporate employees, retail employees, manufacturing, distribution centers, and that's a really unique benefit. I know we're still talking about paid sick time, obviously we're beyond that, but the idea that you can get out in your communities and serve, whether it's at your kids' schools, we've even extended it for people who want to help take care of their coworkers who are going through cancer treatments and things of that nature. So I mean, I think the whole idea of, you know, individuals and helping and giving people the time to do those things and then coming back and feeling fulfilled is really important.
What I have not heard yet is anyone talking about global corporations, the large work world, and whether or not or how that's impacting some of this. I know I was at the Computer Sciences Corporation until I came into the administration, and with 90,000 people across the globe, everything goes up in the air when you're dealing with 18,000 people in India and 8,000 people in Australia, because the time zones just completely, you know, scramble everything. But is that a piece that's generating more awareness and sensitivity about this, or is it just not really particular?
Absolutely. So we're at 140 countries. We have 138,000 employees around the world. And it very much drives, when you're on the call and at
3 a.m.
in Europe, and then it's 11 p.m. in Asia, and everything in between, then the ability to be able to flex your schedule to be able to deal with that becomes even more important, because otherwise you'd be around the clock, literally.
Yeah.
So we definitely live, at least in our company, in a world that it almost feels like it never stops, because we follow the sun in terms of the way the business goes, right? So it drives a lot of the need to have far more people be able to flex their schedule however they need to do, because they may be a few hours in the morning, mm-hmm. no working in the afternoon, and then they have a few hours in the afternoon or the evening because they're on the calls with Asia.
Yeah, it really scrambles things.
I have a PhD student who's actually doing a dissertation on this very topic of global teams and how they flex and its impact on performance and employees. If any organizations are interested in her helping you or doing some research, send your cards to her.
I'll tell you who to talk to at CSC. Yeah, somebody down here had a comment.
I don't do the studies, but I live that basically. So, you know, the people that I work with primarily are in the U.S. and Europe and Canada. And I work for a global company, DuPont. We have 60,000 employees in over 60 countries. This is the time where flexibility is more transparent than ever, because it is a rarity when I go to a face-to-face meeting. Yes. I am on Connect Web meeting all the time, early in the morning with Europe or late at night with Asia. And they have no idea that I work 32 hours a week. It is just completely transparent.
I spent the last year at CSC basically working in my pajamas.
Sure, it's less of an issue now for professionals.
The question, though, is a universal one of how you integrate the different parts of your life for mutual gain. And though it plays out differently in different cultural contexts, it seems that everybody wants it and needs it. So we do work in South America, in the Middle East, and in Asia. And while, you know, again, the cultural context, what does it mean to integrate community and family life in Japan as opposed to in Argentina? These are very different kinds of contexts, of course, but the pressure to find time and attention for the people and communities that matter to you is a universal one. And so it's all the more reason to have all the learning that happens and the training and online and on-demand tools to be local. One of the themes I think that's emerged from this conversation is how important it is to have local solutions, like very super local, like at the level of the individual.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
You can have programs and policies that are extremely supportive and funded from the top, but if they're not understood and accessed at the very local level, then they just don't get used.
So there's two pieces here. One is that there has to be a very local face to this, and a leadership norm about it. I mean, it's you got to be doing both.
You know, there's a whole other area which shocked me when I got into this work. And these are people who work in call centers, and whoever it was who was assuming that all these good companies, as opposed to all these good companies who have great reputations, some of them, for how they treat their employees, spent many millions of dollars getting telephone systems set up that people work at. Those people, I didn't even know this was going on in this country, those people are not allowed to go to the bathroom without it being programmed in from the computer. This is really true, and I won't tell you the names of some companies where this is going on, because it would be shocking to you. Those people also have a certain amount of time that they're allowed to take off from work without pay, but take off without getting fired. As one woman said to me, I have three children, so I'm only allowed the same amount of time off as a woman with one child or no child. And she said, I cannot tell you how many people I know who have lost their jobs because their kids got sick, and they had to take care of them, and they had exceeded the allowed number of days off. This is pretty horrible, and this is 2010. So you should not assume that all these companies who have lovely opportunities for a lot of their workers are not engaged in this kind of practice. And it is really not necessary for them to get their work done in that fashion.
I think the training that is so important is that technology can turn into another form of Big Brother.
Yes.
Having technology gives us flexibility, but and your example of allowing everyone to work from home doing the calls, but you can also watch when people are online. I mean, that's how we knew who was online during the snowstorm last month. 58% of GSA was working because they were online. Well, we knew that. And you have to, I think, really think about access to that kind of data.
I was just going to riff off of your comment, and suggest that an opportunity for research exists here with respect to the demerit system that these employers are utilizing, which is what you're describing. And the Department of Labor, I believe, at one point collected information about the presence, just merely the presence, and I'm sure we could drill down further, of a demerit system by an employer, just so that we could have a grasp on the extent stand and so on and so forth.
If I could segue, we have our Women's Bureau Director here. I'm sure she introduced herself already, Sarah Diaz. And we're going to be collecting data through the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, so we can get research. That's what we find ourselves in a situation where we don't have good data, and it's not easily able to collect. So very important issue. And the other one is that I mentioned earlier on the panel, and that is that this administration is actually putting out competitive grants to states to explore what this means. Not to have a heavy hand in it, but to say, if you have the notion that you want to do this, create a system where you can have paid leave for your employees overall, both public and private, then we're going to help you establish that, at least get the foundation in, get the tools, get the research in. And these will be grants even to folks that have already started the program. And right now, with budget crunches being what it is, this is very important, and especially for all the reasons that all of you here have brought up. So it's a way to kind of even shine a light on those states that are doing good, but maybe helping those states that could use this information as well and make some comparisons.
You always want to end a meeting when everybody has something more to say. Because that means that the next 25 minutes before you have to be in your seats for the president means you can do some quick networking catching up. So I just can't tell you how much I appreciate you being here. This has been very rich. I appreciate everybody jumping in and being crisp in your comments. And be downstairs at 4:25. 4:25. Watch your clocks. Okay.